This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. One of Northwest Indiana state lawmakers, Democratic Senator Karen Talion of Ogden Dunes, recently visited Winnipeg, Manitoba, Canada for a meeting that covered trade between the U.S. and Canada and some other issues that affect both sides of the border. And she joined us on Regionally Speaking recently to talk about it and some other topics as well. Tell us a little bit about what the U.S. and the Canadian Midwestern legislators get together and talk about on a regular basis and how you've gotten involved in this organization.
It's called the Conference of State Governments. It's a national organization, but they all so split into regional areas. So normally every year I attend the Midwestern States Conference of State Government meeting, which also includes several of the Canadian provinces. And we meet once a year in you know, sort of traveling places. Last year it was in Des Moines, and I belong, along with Senator Ed Charbonneau from Valparaiso, I belong to a group called the U.S.-Canada Relations Committee. Mm-hmm. And last year when we were in Des Moines, we knew that NAFTA was being renegotiated. And so we had a committee, and I was a co-chair of that committee, to sort of keep track of what was going on with the NAFTA negotiations. And then the idea was that we would come back here to this year's meeting, which was in Manitoba, and kind of report on what's going on. Well, little did we know that it would be the hottest topic going. And in the meantime, my co-chair, who was a Canadian legislator, was ousted in Ontario's recent elections. Mm. So I ended up being the chairman of this committee myself.
Well, congratulations.
I suppose.
Yeah,
exactly.
This is a rather dubious honor, I would imagine. So I know that we're talking about NAFTA in terms from President Donald Trump as being the worst trade deal ever made. Well, that sounds more like might be it's an exaggeration. I'm sure there have been worse trade deals than that, but we know that NAFTA has been a big benefit to everybody that's been involved over the years.
Well, and you know, the thing is that when you're looking at NAFTA, you know, NAFTA really has a couple of different aspects to it. I mean, there's our trade relationships with Mexico, and then there's our trade relationships with Canada. And I don't know if the listeners know this, but the U.S. Canada is the United States' number one trade partner, more than anyone else, even China. And even in the Midwest, you know, even in Indiana, Canada is a big trade partner for the state of Indiana. And so it's very critical, you know, the Canadians especially were very aware of what's going on and were very, I can say, both upset and wondering what, you know, what was going on in the states. So
I would imagine that in light of all the comments that have been made about NAFTA, and now on top of all of that, we have the concern about the tariffs that are being levied by the United States against Canada and Mexico, that NAFTA and certainly the relationship that we here in Indiana that you're helping represent have with Canada is even more important than probably than ever before.
Well, and like I said, you know, Indiana and the Midwestern states have a lot of trade with Canada. In some of the Dakotas, Kansas, Nebraska, and Indiana, there are a lot of agriculture goods and cattle and that move back and forth across the border just the same way our car parts do. Mm-hmm. You wouldn't think of that, but you know, up in the Great Plains states, cattle move back and forth. They are born in one place, move to another feedlot to get fattened up, move to a different place for packaging, and so there is a big trade with the Canadians on all of those things, not only agriculture goods, but also on manufactured goods.
In your talks with your colleagues, not only from the U.S., but also your Canadian counterparts when you were up in Manitoba, You've obviously had this to talk about too, but I'm sure that you probably have to figure out some type of strategy that you feel you can do for your own part to help deal with what is being tossed out from Washington.
Well, that's a really interesting point, because sometimes as state legislators, you know, we sit around Indiana and say, oh, gee, look what the feds are doing. We don't like that. What can we as state legislators do about it? And I think the general feeling at this conference, and I'm talking Republican farmers from North Dakota and Democrat manufacturing senators from Northwest Indiana, we were all saying, look, the U.S.-Canadian trade is really important, and we can't jeopardize this. So, you know, it was a bipartisan feeling that we have to be really careful. And, you know, when I say that there's a difference between the Canadians and the Mexican trade, you know, one of the things that's been pointed out is that for the most part, the U.S. and the Canadian industries and workers kind of play on the same playing field. Our wages are similar. You know, there's bilateral equal trade between the U.S. and Canada. I find that that a lot of the problems that people express about NAFTA are really about the U.S. and Mexico relations, where, you know, where the wages are not what they are here, and where you get situations like what happened in Indianapolis with Carrier.
Yeah, I was going to mention that's the big point there, the fact that we've had an entire company decide to move all of their manufacturing south of the border because the labor costs are so much cheaper than they are in Indiana or even the United States for that matter. So certainly I can see why it comes up as a very serious question. It's the south border that really the real dispute, I suppose, over NAFTA kind of lies right now, doesn't it?
Yeah, there are some other issues with NAFTA and some of the problems that have emerged over the last 20 years, but you know, like how you settle disputes, but that's sort of a subset of problems. The biggest problem that we have, I think, is this wage discrepancy between, you know, the Canadian-U.S. group and the Mexico wage lower wages.
Mm-hmm. You had an opportunity, I understand, to while you're up in Manitoba, to talk with Canadian Minister for Natural Resources, Mr. Carr, and he had some interesting conversations. I had a chance, I'm sure, to talk a lot about what not only natural resources Canada offers, but the products that come from those natural resources. And you brought up one of your topics that you've kept a close eye on over the years, and that's the use of industrial hemp. Tell us how that conversation started and how it's kind of developed to this point.
Well, actually, it was really interesting, and I didn't really realize when I went in that the person that I was talking to, James Carr, is the Canadian federal minister of the Department of Natural Resources. Mm-hmm. That would be like talking to one of United States cabinet members. I thought I was getting a provincial guy. This was the federal guy, and he asked to talk to me, I guess, because I was head of this NAFTA subcommittee. And it was really interesting because I think that, you know, I expected him to kind of grill me on the ins and outs of what the NAFTA negotiations were, but he didn't do that at all. What he really wanted was to get a kind of feel of where the American people were on this issue, and were the American people angry with Canada, or you know how that was going. I think he wanted a more regional look at just exactly how Americans, mm-hmm, not in power, felt about U.S.-Canada relations. The hemp thing actually was a different discussion. You know, the Canadians are getting ready to expand marijuana use even further. But for the last 20 years, the Canadians have been doing research and development on on industrial hemp, meaning the use of, you know, fiber for paper or fiber for materials, fiber for fabric or something to insert into concrete. They are so far ahead of us, Chris. They are 20 years worth of research and development. They are so far ahead of us on that issue. It's going to be hard for us to catch up. I understand that Purdue is looking to position itself at, you know, the ag department at Purdue, which mm-hmm. is nationally famous, is looking to position itself in that field. But I don't know that we're going to catch up with people who've been doing this for 20 years.
Well, and even with a 20-year head start, we know that that the United States was not necessarily a leader in the use of industrial hemp. We're talking, you know, 60 years ago during World War II, but they were doing very well because a lot of products, including such commonplace things as rope, were coming from the hemp plants that were grown, and we know that over the years Indiana played a large role, at least in helping develop some of the products that they came out of that industrial hemp. So
exactly, and then we just sort of let it go. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
One thing too, I want to be able to bring up while we have you here with us on Regionally Speaking is to talk a little Indiana Democratic Party politics. We know that as we approach just a matter of months away from the November 6th general election. We have, of course, a lot of attention being focused on the U.S. Senate race, where Senator Joe Donnelly is hoping to keep his seat in Washington. And then we have, of course, others that are other Democrats and other officials who are on the ballot as well, too. We know that they're keeping an eye on the polls, too. You're and yourself included on being on the list as well, too, of those running for re-election. What kind of polling information do you get hold of lately here that tells how the voters out there think about the candidates that are on the ballot?
That's a really interesting question. I'm glad you brought that up, Chris. We, you know, of course, in election years, we all do polling to see what is, you know, on the top priorities in the minds of the voters. You know, 2008, 2009, we had a big recession here, nationally, of course, and it hit Indiana hard. And at that time, the number one issue, you know, in voters' minds were jobs and the economy. Well, it's now 9-ish years later, and we have pretty much full employment. We've, you know, I talk to people. People are working. Things are going well, and yet when you ask the voters still, their number one concern is jobs and the economy. And I'm really, really sort of struggling to figure out, to kind of parse that and figure out exactly what do they mean by that. Are they worried about, I mean, maybe we've just been saying it for so long that that's our automatic response. But I get the feeling that people are worried about wages and the fact that wages are not necessarily keeping up with the inflation. And also about stability. I got that answer a few days ago from some workers that I talked to. They're worried that, you know, given the tariffs, given the trade wars that are being, you know, that are going on in Washington right now, they're worried about the stability of their jobs. But I really would like to hear more from local people. As to exactly what they mean when they say they're worried about jobs in the economy.
Do you think that perhaps that maybe what they're referring to, or they're using certainly as an example, is the vast changes that have happened in the workplace by technology? For example, we have fewer people that have to run the steel mills than there were 20 years ago. When you used to have a full complement of hundreds of people on shift, you don't have to have that many now. And there are a lot of jobs that technology has basically completely changed around, and that in turn has made it. We know that the state officials are, and even the governor has talked about this too. I know that about workforce development. How do you get people trained for the jobs of the 21st century? Do you think that maybe that their concerns are kind of blended in with that too? But they're bringing it on a local basis there.
Well, that may be part of it. I was at a workforce conference a few days ago in Indianapolis, and you know, we talked about the number of jobs that are left unfilled in Indiana right now that people aren't trained for and they can't get jobs. And then we're also talking about training people who are maybe in lower wage jobs to sort of move up into higher paying jobs if they get training and a little more education. But some of the low-wage jobs, service jobs, janitorial jobs, working in retail. You know, we have a huge number of retail workers that don't get paid, that get paid well below what we call living wage. It's higher than minimum wage, but it's not a wage that will support a family. There are always going to be those jobs. People, you know, so we need to attack this from both sectors. We need to look at, you know, moving people who are able to get a little more education, moving them up into higher paid jobs. But we also need to take care of the people, and there are always going to be service sector jobs. We need to take care of them as well by making sure that their wages are enough to support a family.
So you get this impression that's what one of the things, if not the number one thing that is on people's minds here in Northwest Indiana, among other things, is focusing on that. And so these other issues that get passed around in the national marketplace don't count as much as apparently jobs and stability and security.
I think that's right. Well, here's another. So the number two highest polling issue was education, good education, K through 12. And yet, and we, you know, spend a lot of money on that in Indiana. And yet, about 3 or 4 months ago, they came out. There's a national organization that does National Educational Statistics Association. There really are organizations with names like that. They came out with a study that they had done over the last 15 years looking at how teachers' salaries are keeping up with inflation. Indiana, unfortunately, is number 50. So I can see that, you know, yeah, they have a job, but their wages aren't progressing to keep up with inflation. And so they, you know, in relative terms, they may be worse off than they were 15 years ago.
That's State Senator Karen Talion of Ogden Dunes. You're listening to Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. It's time now for another edition of Green Fleet Radio. And here's your host, Carl Lissick.
Well, thank you for that introduction. And today our guest is Mr. Kevin Kirkham. He's the Manager of Business Development for NIPSCO. Kevin, welcome back to the show.
Thank you very much. Pleased to be here.
Always great to have our great partner, NIPSCO, on the show to hear about all the great things that you're working on. So I think most of our listeners, Kevin, know who NIPSCO is. But for those who don't, can you give a quick overview of the company and what NIPSCO does?
Sure. Yeah, we're the electric and gas utility for Northern Indiana. We serve about 850,000 gas customers and about 450,000 electric customers.
So I know some of our listeners are interested in renewable energy and helping to promote clean energy for environmental reasons. Can you give our listeners an overview of what kind of programs NIPSCO offers and to help these types of customers?
Sure, yeah. Renewable energy has been kind of a hot topic for customers over the past several years and gained momentum. Currently, NIPSCO, we have three programs to offer our customers that are interested in this type of environment for their service. And the first one is going to be our Green Power program. And then we also offer a feed-in tariff program and net metering program for those that would like to actually install the solar panels or wind power at their property.
Well, that's fun. These programs sound great. So let's focus on the Green Power program for a bit. So how much does it cost to participate in this program, Kevin?
Sure. It's interesting that the current rate for customers would be about $1.80 per month for a residential home. This assumes that you would consume about 1,000 kWh, which is slightly higher than the average customer. But for easy math, it works out that it's about $1.80 per month for 1,000 kilowatt hours. And so what that represents is that customers that want to help this technology along, and so they're looking for ways to contribute and promote that technology. So what NIPSCO has is a green power program that will purchase renewable energy credits for customers to help promote renewable technology for their consumption. So customers can consume either 100, they can select up 100% of their consumption to be green power, or 50% or 25%. So if they represent and select 100% of their consumption to be green power, then that would roughly equal about $1.80 per month.
I see. So how can customers be sure their power actually is designated that comes from renewable energy sources?
Great question. So under this program, NIPSCO belongs to what a Green E certification program. And Green E is a national certification program all across the country that utilities belong to and others. And they will track the actual consumption that is selected under this program to make sure that there's a renewable energy credit that's purchased for every kWh that belongs to this program. And we actually go through an external audit process to ensure that the tracking mechanisms and all our documentation are in order so that what customers are believing they're signing up for is actually happening.
Sure. You're listening to Green Fleet Radio. Today our guest is Mr. Kevin Kirkham, Manager of Business Development for NIPSCO. So Kevin, let's focus on customers that perhaps want to do more and install their own solar generation or wind turbines. You mentioned in the net metering program that in a feed-in tariff program, but what would be the next step for these listeners who want to learn more or perhaps enroll in these programs, Kevin?
Sure. The first thing I would say is do some research. You can start at the NIPSCO.com website and learn about all three different types of programs and the technology that's being offered. And if you're interested in doing more than the green power and actually installing the technology at your house, meaning solar panels or wind turbines, after doing your research, get at least three quotes from contractors.
Sure.
That way, you can determine if the cost is right for you and you're not being taken advantage of. Once you have three quotes, then you kind of do an assessment if is the financial return what you're looking for in a project.
I see. And so what happens if a customer installs solar on their home and is enrolled in one of these programs and decides to sell their house?
That's no problem at all. So if you are if you have a net metering a program or feed-in tariff program, you're going to have a contract with NIPSCO for the sale of that power. And that contract can be assigned to the new homeowner.
I see.
So that's not an issue, and it really will provide a value for your home, because now you're selling a home that has solar panels with a renewable contract that can go with that home sale.
Wonderful, wonderful. So how can our listeners learn more about the NIPSCO programs?
So you can start with the NIPSCO.com website. That would be the first place. There's a lot of information out there. There's different links you can go to, as well as frequently asked questions to hopefully answer any of those questions. Mm-hmm. And if you really have additional questions beyond that, call us at NIPSCO, 1-800-4-NIPSCO, and then we'll get to the right person to answer your questions.
Wonderful. So as we come to the close of our program, Kevin, any closing thoughts to our listeners?
Costs for renewable energy have come down drastically over the years. So the past 20 years, it's dropped over 70%. So it's really becoming affordable and a good way for those that want to do more for the environment. If that cost is still a hurdle for you, please take advantage of our green power program, because $1.80 per month really can help promote renewable sources. And you can tell all your friends and family that your power being delivered to your house and your consumption is coming from renewable resources.
Great information, as always, Kevin. Thank you very much. And that will do it for today's edition of the Green Fleet Radio. Thank you again to Kevin Kirkham, Manager of Business Development for NIPSCO. And I'm your host, Carl Lissick. Thanks for joining us. And remember, it's never too late to begin your environmental legacy. Thank you.
Green
Thank
Fleet.
You.
Thanks, Kevin.
Green Fleet Radio is made possible by South Shore Clean Cities. And if you missed the Green Fleet Radio today, you can catch it later on All Things Considered. And you can always catch all of the Green Fleet Radio episodes on our website, lakeshorepublicradio.org, as well as on NPR One. Just search for WLPR. Indiana Wesleyan University is granting diplomas to its residential and non-residential students in two separate ceremonies this coming weekend. More than 1,200 undergraduate, graduate, and doctoral degrees will be conferred, and we get to talk with one person who is going to be participating in the commencement ceremonies, and it's a 26-year-old Hammond resident who has gone through a lot to become a college graduate. And Flora Padilla is joining us here from her home. Flora, welcome to Regionally Speaking.
Hi, thank you for having me.
Well, you're quite a lady. You've gone through a lot as not only as a mom and as a wife, but also now as a college student. And you certainly finally you will get to say a college graduate come up here. Tell us a little bit about first what it feels like to be the first member of your family to earn a college degree.
It's definitely unreal, and it's a bittersweet feeling. It was definitely a struggle to get where I am today, and I know that many people may be thinking, oh, you know, it's just an associate's, it's only 2 years. But to me, it was probably the 2 years that I struggled the most to get a college degree from IWU and with no help from home or little support. And now, thanks to, you know, IWU and the program that they ran, I can continue that. And I'm really excited to graduate. I can't believe the day is here. And 2 years have passed by since I began studying for this degree.
Now, when you have such a busy work and life schedule, how did you manage to be able to fit in time to study and time to do your homework?
It's funny because my cheerleaders actually asked me the same thing. It was honestly all pure motivation. On my way to games, any away games that we had, I studied on the bus or I would complete my discussions there. I would also take my laptop to work, and at lunch I would sit in my car and catch up on my reading. Sometimes at IWU, I would explain to the professors, hey, I'm going to be running late because I'm getting out of work at such a late time. I have to pick up my daughter from daycare, take her to a new sitter, and then I have to drive in and to IWU. And IWU is 40 minutes away, and they were completely okay with it. They allowed me to be a few minutes late, but I did it, and through little breaks here and there, I was able to focus on my work, and I would put my daughter to bed at like 9 p.m. and study until midnight, maybe 1 or 2 in the morning.
Now, you gave us a little hint as to what your daily schedule is like here. Let me ask you, Flora, when does your day actually begin, and when do you actually get to start studying, I guess?
My day every day begins at around 5:30 a.m. when my alarm goes off. I don't have much help with my daughter because I'm a single mom, and so she has to be dropped off at daycare by 7, so I have to get up, shower, get ready, get my daughter ready, get her things ready, have her at daycare by 7. By 7:30, I have to be at work. I get out of work at 4, pick her up from daycare, and go to cheerleading practice by 4:30 or by 5 o'clock is when my cheerleading practice would begin for my high school varsity team. And then practice would run until 6:30. Then I would get home around 7, have dinner, feed my daughter, play with her for a little bit, and then put her down hopefully by 9. And that was on the good days.
Wow. And you have time to breathe in between, I suppose, too. It's amazing. You talk about cheerleading, and that's an important part of your life, we know, besides your work and getting ready for school, and of course, your daughter. You're I guess, a graduate of George Rogers Clark High School in Gary, in Hammond. And and you were also the varsity cheerleading squad coach. Were you a cheerleader while you were at Clark?
I was cheerleader for about 2 years, and I made captain of the varsity team my sophomore year. And then last year, I heard that their cheerleading coach had quit, and the secretary who actually works at Clark was my ex-coach, and she reached out to me, and she said, you know, I know you work for the school city of Hammond now. Is there any way that you'll be able to coach these girls? And I flew out of my seat because I've always wanted to be a coach for a cheerleading team, and I said, absolutely. I went there that same day I was hired, and ever since then, it's been history.
Now, I guess you mentioned your job here, and you work for Calumet College of St. Joseph in Whiting, and you work in the admissions department. What do your colleagues that work there and the folks that are Calumet College have to say about you pursuing your associate's degree?
They are excited. They are happy to know that I'm finally graduating.
my coworker, Melissa, has been there every step of the way. She's been encouraging me. And it's just so exciting to know, you know, I'm finally graduating with my associates, and now I'll finally be able to move on for my bachelor's and maybe in the future even get my master's, because that's my ultimate goal.
Now, you were, I guess, planning to graduate in December. Why did you wait until the summer and when the end of the semester for the summer months? And there had to be a pretty good reason why you waited so long.
There was. Actually, my mother divorced my father about 2 years ago. And in Mexico, she, I think, went to school only up to fourth grade. And my father went up to school up to fifth grade because they used their children mainly for forum. And when she came to the U.S. with my father, she was never taught how to learn to drive. So she is like 53 now, and she just started learning 2 years ago. But she refuses to get in the express lane, fears of driving and getting into a car crash. And she refuses to drive in the snow. And I knew that in December, if I graduated, then she would not go to IWU to see me graduate. So I reached out to one of the advisors at IWU, and I asked her, you know, is there any way that I can graduate in August, because I want my mom to go see me to graduate. Oh, sorry, I get emotional talking about it.
That's great. Well, it's quite a difference from December, difference from August to December. So it's a good decision, I see.
Yes. And IWU supported me all the way. And they said, of course, you just have to double up on these classes and check with financial aid first and check out all your options first before you fully go through with this. And I said, of course I will. And I did, and I set my schedule. Well, I forced it to fit my schedule. And I completed it, and I'm excited. I get to graduate in August, and my mom's going to be there, and my fiance and my family's going to be there. So I'm really, really excited.
We're talking to Flora Padilla, who is 26 years old. She's from Hammond, and being a single mom and working very hard as a secretary and taking care of her daughter as well. She's going to be the first member of her family to attend or graduate from college when she gets her diploma from Indiana Wesleyan University this coming weekend. What advice would you give to women just like you who might be considering pursuing a college degree?
I would say that if you can't imagine yourself completing a bachelor's, imagine completing an associate's, and focus your time and effort into that. Imagine yourself walking across the stage with a loved one in the audience, whether it's your mom, dad, father, or your son, or your daughter, and envision them waving in excitement as you receive that degree. And just to keep fighting, you're going to cross that finish line. And once you do, it's going to be the dream finally coming true. And all your hard work that you did, it's going to be right there in front of you.
Well, that's wonderful. That's wonderful. I understand, too, that the ceremonies that are coming up here at the Chapel Auditorium in Marion, I guess where the main campus is for IWU, is going to be put on webcast as well. So you can go on the Indiana Wesleyan University website and take a look at the commencement there, too. So have a chance for folks who couldn't make the trek down to see more of it as well, too. Now, what's the next for you and your plans?
Well, next I'll be completing my bachelor's at Kenwood College of St. Joseph's, because now since I work here, it's going to fit my schedule a little bit easier, and they're going to be able to pay for it. But I do plan on returning to IWU to receive my master's.
That's great. Do you have any ideas of what you would like to do in particular for a career, since you'll eventually have your full-fledged degree in business administration?
I do. I want to work for a nonprofit organization. Hopefully be, you know, at the head and run an organization, be able to help others out, possibly help out single mothers who doubted themselves once in their lifetime, and just give them that confidence to know that they can do it. And if they put their mind to it, they can do it. And just work for a nonprofit organization that's going to help someone out. That's truly what I'm looking into already.
Now, I have to ask you, too, since you're a single mom, what does your daughter think about this?
She's 3, so I have no idea. She was actually in a little program, and she had her little graduation, too, from the state of Indiana. She graduated just like we did. She received her little hat, and she was so excited. So I'm hoping that maybe when she sees me walking, she's going to put 2 and 2 together and say, hey, mom's graduating, too, you know. And I'm just so excited to be able to tell my daughter, hey, you saw me graduate, and it was because of you that I did this, too.
We've been talking with Flor Padilla. She's 26. She's from Hammond. And as we mentioned before, she's the first in her family to attend or graduate from college. And she is going to get her Associate of Science degree in Business Management from Indiana Wesleyan University on campus on August 11th. Congratulations to you in advance and and the best of luck and working in the extra hours and time that you'll spend to go ahead and get your bachelor's and hopefully get your master's too. Thank you for being with us to talk about it.
Thank you. I hope you have a good day today.
Thank you. Some Hoosiers are worried that the future votes they cast could be compromised after hearing about Russia meddling in the 2016 election and some congressional campaigns as well. As Congress considers how to improve election security, state and local governments are taking their own precautions. And Indiana Public Broadcasting's Barbara Brozier says that Indiana's system does have several vulnerabilities to deal with.
Teresa Smith is taking me to the bottom floor of the Greene County Courthouse.
It does say, this door does say restricted area.
She's the voter registration clerk for the county and one of three people who has access to a special room down here that houses the county's voting machines and electronic polling books.
They are behind two locked doors. There's only two keys to get into that room. One of them is with the voter registration office and with the clerk's office.
The security protocol is so strict that Smith only lets me through one of those locked doors. While the county has been practicing these security policies for a while, the election board only formally adopted them earlier this month. It seemed necessary with all of the recent news of foreign governments and hackers meddling in elections. Voter registration assistant Steve Magner says the county's vote machines are relatively secure.
They're never connected to the internet where they could be hacked into or altered, which is most people's concerns that their vote might be altered or, results changed.
But there are other ways the machines could be manipulated. Scott Shackelford is chair of Indiana University's cybersecurity program. He says the conversation about election security goes beyond equipment.
So if you really wanted to attack Indiana's, for example, voting integrity, you wouldn't have to just go after the voting machines. You could, for example, go after websites that people go to figure out where their polling places are. You could snarl traffic. You could shut down the power grid in a worst-case scenario in certain core swing counties.
And several recent reports point to vulnerabilities in Indiana's election security systems. The Center for American Progress gave the state a failing grade in an election security analysis released earlier this year. It says the state doesn't back up voting machines with a paper record and doesn't mandate post-election audits to test for accuracy. And a Pew Trust analysis from 2014 ranks Indiana 31st on its overall elections performance index, which assesses factors like data completeness, post-election audits, and ballot problems. But Shackelford says the state is making progress.
The good news is that we have a Secretary of State here in Indiana who is at the head of the pack. She's currently the president, Connie Lawson, of the Secretaries of State's Association and has taken cybersecurity really seriously.
Lawson's office plans to use nearly $7.6 million in grant funding from the federal government to try and address some of the challenges. Among other things, the money will be used to evaluate election computers and harden the network systems they use. The state also plans to deploy auditable voting systems and improve election night reporting. And Shackelford says there's a new network that allows election officials to better communicate about problems.
We now have something called a voting ISAC, an information sharing and analysis center, to help these election officials share cyber threat data and best practices across the country.
But Shackelford says it's not enough to stop interference in November. He says that shouldn't impact whether Hoosiers decide to cast a ballot, though, because that's exactly what those trying to interfere with the election are hoping for. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Barbara Brozier.
This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. Former FBI Director James Comey is going to be the first speaker September 9th to kick off the 2018 Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum series of speakers. What's the rest of the season going to be like? Well, Leslie Plesac came on Regionally Speaking to give us the rundown, beginning with a famous photographer who will be speaking in early October.
Really, really excited about hosting Platon. And his name is Platon Antonio. He goes by Platon. And he actually, after working for British Vogue for several years, he was invited to New York City to work for the late John Kennedy Jr. in his political magazine, George, if you remember that. And Platon has taken photos for a number of very recognizable publications, including the New York Times Magazine, Vanity Fair, Esquire, GQ, and the list goes on. But he's probably most known for he has over 20 covers on Time Magazine, and one in particular that I think most of us are familiar with was the image of Vladimir Putin when he was Time Magazine's Person of the Year back in 2007. And he is a storyteller, so he talks about his portrait. The title of his talk is called Powerful Portrait, An Intimate Look at Humanity and Leadership. And he really does talk about the person behind the portrait, how he got the portrait. And what I love about him, he came highly recommended from the Richmond, Virginia Forum. Bill Chapman is the executive director there, and he said to me, your audience will laugh, they will cry, they will be really, really mesmerized by his photography. So I'm super excited to bring in Platon on October 7th, and he will be the first speaker on our campus in Westville on October 7th at 4 o'clock. So really excited if you're interested in the arts, if you're interested in politics, very entertaining.
Now, on October 28th, another Sunday, we have Reshma Sajani, who I guess is talking about women, technology, and leadership. Tell us more about her and how she's going to be able to approach these topics when she comes to speak.
Okay. So Reshma Sajani is definitely a mover and a shaker and a very, I think we're going to hear more about her, but she is the founder and CEO of a national nonprofit called Girls Who Code. And Girls Who Code is working to close the gender gap in technology. So if you consider the number of differences between men and women, often in the sciences and technology and computer technology fields, there is a discrepancy. And so in 2012, this organization was started to teach girls both in middle school and high school coding skills. But what's amazing about it is that she has realized that it goes much deeper. And so she talks about how boys and girls are socialized differently and look at challenges and opportunities differently. And she's a great speaker. I think she's going to be really entertaining. She's going to talk about gender equity, which certainly is another timely topic for us. So I'm really excited about Reshma joining us on Sunday, October 28th.
That's great. Now, on November 11th, another political speaker, or we should say not necessarily political in nature, but he's certainly keeping his eye on the political science field, is Robert Costa. And people may recognize his name and maybe even his face by watching him on public television. Tell us what Robert does what's he going to talk about?
Yeah, so Robert Costa also has a tie to the area that he's a Notre Dame grad. And so he is going to, the title of his talk is called Inside 2018, Understanding the Midterm Election. So he's speaking on November 11th, which is the Sunday after the midterm elections. And he's really going to help us analyze and break down what we see happen in the midterm elections. There's lots of conversation about what might happen, and he will cover that with us. So he's a national political reporter. He writes for the Washington Post, and he was recently named the moderator of PBS's Washington Week. He's a regular on Meet the Press. He's a regular on Morning Joe. And I think that he is kind of a younger and up-and-coming political analyst. So he's going to join us on the stage to answer our questions, to take a look in almost real time at what happens during the midterm election.
Now, finally, on December 2nd, on Sunday, December 2nd, Coach Lou Holtz is coming to town. And of course, anybody who's either an Irish student or fan, a faculty member, anybody who appreciates the University of Notre Dame will definitely want to hear what this legendary coach has to say, I'm sure.
We have an afternoon planned with legendary Coach Lou Holtz, and his topic is Game Plan for Success. And Lou Holtz has really established himself as one of the most successful college football coaches of our time. And he is also known as one of the great speakers of our time. So people that have seen him before, I've not seen him, but they've told me that he is inspirational, entertaining, and leaves people very, very moved. And I think when you look at the roster of speakers who have spoken at the Sinai Forum over our 65-year history, Lou Holtz certainly belongs there. He has taken six different teams to bowl games. He's won five bowl games with different teams. And, you know, he's probably most known for what he was able to do at Notre Dame when he took them it talks about taking them from not so good to pretty amazing. And so I think it's not really that he's going to be talking about sports, but I think Lou Holtz applies lessons from the field to our lives in general. And I think people will certainly not be disappointed if they join us on December 2nd to hear Lou Holtz speak.
Now, Leslie, as we wrap up here, once again, give us the website where people can find out more about not only the speakers and the series, but find out how they can get their season tickets.
Basically, what you can do, the easiest way to find out about tickets is go to Purdue Northwest's website, which is pnw.edu. And then if you search in the little search bar for Sinai Forum, it'll take you to our page. And there are several tabs. There's a FAQ tab, frequently asked questions. So everything that you want to know about the forum, how tickets are sold, how do I get my tickets, how much do tickets cost. One thing I do want to point out is that students, both high school and college students, not just Purdue students, but any students with a valid student ID, are welcome to attend our programs free of charge. The COMI program does require a student RSVP. That link is on our website as well. No cost, but just an RSVP so we know that we're expecting you.
That's Leslie Plesak with the Purdue University Northwest Sinai Forum. The season tickets selling fast for the 65th season of Speakers. Two Indiana agencies named some chief medical officers recently to lead the efforts to improve the health of Hoosiers. Indiana Public Broadcasting's Jill Sheridan reports that the healthcare leaders will join the Family and Social Services Administration and the Indiana State Department of Health.
Dr. Daniel Raciniak is a toxicologist and professor of emergency medicine at the IU School of Medicine. He will continue that work while leading the FSSA's team of medical directors. State leadership says his public health experience will help guide the social service agency that continues to deal with the addiction crisis. Dr. Melissa Collier also has a public health background focused on epidemiology. Collier will lead efforts at ISDH to reduce infant mortality rates and improve the overall health of Hoosiers. For Indiana Public Broadcasting, I'm Jill Sheridan.
Indiana University says it's encouraging dining services workers to get a hepatitis A vaccine as an outbreak in the state continues to grow. And while there are no cases of this highly contagious liver infection on the Bloomington campus, more than 330 people have been diagnosed with Hep A over the entire state since November. IU is offering the vaccine at its health clinic for students, faculty, and staff. And Indiana University spokesman Chuck Carney says as student dining workers are coming back to campus this week, the university is reminding them about proper hygiene, and they're also educating them about the hepatitis A vaccine.
Because that is something that can spread the disease. If somebody has hepatitis A, that can spread through handling of food and then get into the population that way.
Carney says that Indiana University is also monitoring the hepatitis A outbreak in counties where it has regional campuses as well. Lakeshore Public Radio's furry friend Ollie is joining us in the studio now to answer your pet's questions on Ask Ollie. The pet questions are voiced by man-human Tom Maloney, and Ollie's responses are voiced by his woman-human Victoria Voller. Ask Ollie is supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana.
Dear Ollie, I love summer travel with my family. For many years, we've taken trips all over the country. Some motels and hotels that we stay in are pet-friendly, and some aren't. I'm small and get smuggled into non-pet-friendly properties where I'm cautioned not to bark. Some of the pet-friendly hotels and motels are very nice, some aren't. This year, we're going on a staycation, which I believe means that we are staying put within the geographic parameter set by one fuel tank. We might stay at a local hotel just for fun, or if the fuel prices come down some more, we might do some traveling by car to Michigan or Wisconsin. My owners wonder which hotels and motels are pet-friendly, and what does that really mean? Well, Victoria, I can remember growing up as a kid and taking cross-country trips, and I guess kind of long before the days of maybe pet-friendly hotels, the dog would stay in the car overnight, and we would leave the sunroof open, and we would take shifts. So somebody would have to go sleep in the car with the dog to make sure everything was okay and the dog wasn't freaking out and it wasn't too hot for the dog. But I would have loved, maybe not for flea purposes, but sleep purposes. I'm fully on board with pet-friendly hotels.
We've done that as well. I mean, people do, and especially if they have a very large dog that they can't smuggle in. But my husband and I are real good at smuggling in dogs that don't bark. Dear Sunny, in answer to your letter, it's that time of year again when Fido or Fidette, I mean Bella or Bob, get packed into the family car with all the luggage and picnic baskets. For a traveling pet, you are living at the right time in history. All across the nation, a large percentage of hotel and motel industry marketing money is being used to develop ads directed at attracting the four-legged traveler and their pet parents. More often than not, traveling baby boomers with an empty nest have filled that nest with their vehicles with one or more four-legged companions. Hotel and motel owners realize that a well-groomed and very well-behaved animal is a good guest. Dogs and cats never steal towels. They don't take the Bibles or take pictures off the walls. They don't even get drunk or disorderly, and they never run out without paying the bill. Some hotels, like the Hotel Monaco in Chicago, reward the furry guest by giving each a gift basket filled with canine goodies. You can search the internet at pethotels.com for hotels and motels that welcome dogs and have reviews. Our family likes to go to La Quinta properties because they are everywhere and accept dogs with no questions asked. The Chicago Wyndham, some Hampton Inns, and Marriott's welcome guests. A select group of Hilton properties are pet-friendly, and all of the Kimpton hotels like Chicago Allegro accept pets. While randomly surfing the internet, I caution you to be very careful. First, a percentage of hotels or motels charge a big, fat service fee, or what they call a pet damage deposit, that you may never in your lifetime see again. Secondly, the quality of some hotels and motels is so awful that in desperation to attract business, the owner throws up a sign outside the yard advertising that pets are welcome. Sure they are. The rooms are unkempt, the door handles fall off, the mirrors are smeared, but not by poltergeists, and the toilet seat is lying against the bathroom wall. Beware of that sign. Like the Bates Hotel, made famous by the film Psycho, no human or pet would ever choose to spend a night there. I sign this, Ollie, your friend in fur, and remember that love is a four-legged word.
Have a question for Ollie? You can email it to ollie@lakeshorepublicmedia.org and ask Ollie, supported by the Humane Society of Northwest Indiana. That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us. Tomorrow is Thursday. It's Reporters Roundtable Thursday, and that means we'll invite members of the local and regional media to join us to talk about the stories in print as well as online.